Am I on? I'm not. There it is. I'm not on now?
You are. Yep.
You don't know how much fun it is to be with my buddy here. I just look forward to it. So anyway, he said that I have to come up with another topic, so I'll come up with a topic that whenever I look at Bob, I can't help but think of this topic.
Can I leave the room?
The topic is humility. So I thought I'd spend a little time talking about it. The reason is that it's one of the most powerful tools we have available in the program, and I think it gets under-mentioned. And I think one of the culprits is somebody started a sentence. It was around when I got sober, so it's not new. That if you say you're humble, you're not. Or you've heard, or something word to that effect. If you even let the word come out of your mouth, there's something unhumble about that. So no talking about humility. You follow what I'm saying? All of a sudden you go, well, I don't want to be seen as a jerk, so I'm not even going to say the word. And yet the word is, it is so amazingly powerful. And Bill really gets into it in the seventh step in the 12 and 12, which is why Bob and I are big believers in using both books, because there is stuff in the big book that is far superior to the same material in the 12 and 12. But on the other hand, there's a few things in the 12 and 12 that are head and shoulders above the coverage in the big book. This is just in my opinion. And certainly humility is one of the topics that is there. I would call humility the passport out of self-centeredness, and there's no way to get out of there without it. You can't possibly get out of self-centeredness without humility. Because humility is saying, I can't get out of self-centeredness on my own. It's impossible for me, with all my resources, with all my energy, with all my knowledge, I can do nothing about being self-centered. And self-centered is one of the most painful things you can experience. It's the worst place to be in the world. And so when we finally admit that, then since we're not humble, but we've admitted we're self-centered, we immediately say, well, then I'll do something about being self-centered. Oh, really? What are you going to do? What are you going to do to stop being self-centered? Well, I'll just stop being self-centered. Really? You will stop being self-centered. And you find out you can. Now, I don't blame people for being self-centered. I don't know how you could not be self-centered. When we start out in life as a little kid and you go out in the backyard and you look around at the world, guess what's at the center of it while you're looking around? There's the neighbor's house, there's the farm, there's this, and what's in the middle? Me. I mean, you couldn't possibly not conclude that you're at the center of your own little world. So we all should realize that it's not our fault that we ended up self-centered. And if you remember back in history when they thought that the Earth was the center of the solar system, and boy, when the observers who started realizing we weren't, they were bringing some bad news to the people in charge, the kings and everything. They always wanted to kill this guy. Because naturally, why would the Earth be the center of the solar system? Because I live here. That's why it would be the center. The center is where I am. And so we can't help but be the center of our own little world. And that's the painful place that we live, that we're trying to destroy and come into God's world. And with this new pair of glasses, to be able to see a different world. So that when you get up and you see a different world, you're happy. And And that's what humility does. It causes us to realize there's nothing that I can do to get out of self-centeredness. I must have help, and I must always be receiving help. Every time I get my chip every year, they always down in Florida, they go, how many years and how'd you do it? And I always say, by constantly receiving help. That's how I do it, by constantly receiving help. Normally talk about giving help, but receiving help is the key to everything. If we're not receiving it, we're going back to self-sufficiency, which leads to self-centeredness. And that's why humility is such an important thing. It's the opposite of pride. One of the characteristics of humility is it doesn't compare. If you find yourself comparing, you've moved over to pride. This is better than that. This is good, that's wrong. This is the Humility is just accepts and goes on about its business. There's not making any judgments about anything. And I'm learning this at the same time that I am making the proud statement, my group's the best group in AA, and if you don't think your group's the best group in AA, go find another group. Anybody ever hear that one? And I went, uh-oh. I don't think that fits in the humility column. I think that fits in the pride column. So we have to get comfortable with being able to talk about it and just say, boy, you know, humility really helped me out. It made me ask for help. It's a greatest thing to have is this new perspective that I need help constantly. And so that's what Bill is talking about when he says we humbly asked him to remove our shortcomings. And if you start with someone new and you say, do you understand asking him to remove your shortcomings? Yes, I do. I can see myself. Okay, God. Okay, now humbly ask. And then you find out that there's no, we have no idea the difference between regular asking and humbly asking. And that's why we want to study it and come get comfortable with this concept of humility. Humility is not getting my way. It's getting rid of even having a way in order to be in God's world. I have to start destroying my world the way it ought to be. This is the outcome we need. This is the thing. I got to have this. And so that's why this word to me is such a key word. And I learned something new, and then I'll pass it on to Bob. I used to make statements. Bill writes that humility has a hard time of it in our society. And I used to joke and say, you won't see a car manufacturer saying, buy a Porsche, everybody will think you're humble. It just wouldn't sell, you know what I mean? It's not a word that really grabs you. So I said, you'll never see it in the business world. That'll never be a big deal in the business world. And God damn, if I didn't think about, probably about 6 months ago, I said, wait a minute. When you were a little kid, you bought humble gasoline all the time. There was this huge oil company named Humble. It became Exxon. It went in with Standard Oil and became Exxon. So I went and looked up Humble. I said, how did they ever choose the word? How did you start an oil company
Humble, Texas.
And call it Humble? And it came from this little town in Texas. And this is how the town got its name. One of the earliest settlers there before the Civil War. Wait till you hear the guy's name. Pleasant Humble. That was the guy's name. You like that?
Wow.
His name was Pleasant Humble. And they called him Plez. And he moved there and he started, there's a river, I guess the San Jacinto River is right there south of Houston. And he started a ferry boat service and that was how he was earning his living. And then he decided to open a post office in his house. And the second he did that, Humble was on the map. It became an official place. It was later incorporated. It was a lumber town. Then they discovered oil. And so they created this little Humble Oil Company. And then that thing took off. I mean, it was all over the United States. And one of the last commercials they had was put a tiger in your tank. I don't know if any of you remember. They they called it ESSO was another name they used, and ENCO was another name they used. And in the article that I read, they read Texaco was in every state, and this one wasn't in every state, so they had to go and switch their name in order to get in every state. And this is the sentence that they used. The humble oil company executives had to swallow their pride. It just looks funny. The humble had to swallow the pride. And so they became Exxon. And somewhere in this article, somebody from the Green Movement had found a Time or a Life magazine ad from Humble Oil in 1962. And they had a picture of a glacier up in Alaska. I think it's Tico or something like that, glacier. And it said, Humble Oil produces enough energy every day to melt this glacier. And it was kind of an interesting look at the future. Anyway, that's my little trivia about Humble.
Well, the fact that you first of all related the subject to me and then picked one that I don't do particularly well, I mean, makes it kind of difficult to participate. It's interesting. I brought up in a business environment. My dad worked for himself, and I ended up working with a partner, but kind of for ourselves, built my own company. And when I saw myself as a business guy, I was being able to get things done. I was being able to do deals, to be able to affect, you know, problem solution, or this is what you want, you know, take a path and go get it. And especially the last few years when I've had a few issues that I really didn't want to have that were kind of in front of my face. And I've really been touched every time I go read the 7-step and the 12 and 12. Bill's treatment of humility in that is just extraordinary. And what I discovered in that process is I really don't think bad things should happen to me. I mean, I'm not kidding. I mean, I don't know if I think I should be exempt when it happens. The first thing is, you know, I don't want that. What the hell? You know, I mean, can we change it or minimize it? Or? And I think of how stupid. I mean, do you know anybody that doesn't get their, and it isn't. I mean, I don't think I do it pathologically, but I mean, my knee-jerk reaction is, I don't know if my life is good enough that when something, you know, negative or whatever it happens, I don't like it, and I kind of have a reaction to it. And as I get older and those things, I think as I try to develop, I think some sense of humility is I stop this feeling that I should somehow be exempt, that my life should be a procession of pleasure, and that I should be not have the texture that most people have in life. You know, I mean, I commiserate with lots of other people, and I try to have compassion when they're, you know, having difficulty. But, you know, so number one is I stop holding myself as someone who is exempt from gravity. I mean, you know, which I really think that there was an arrogance in my, And then I discover what a strong wanter I am. Mm. I am a wanting machine. I am a deeply shallow person. If you couldn't sell it to me, you ought to get out of the business, is what we used to say. So I was a materialist of the first water. And that's reduced quite a bit, both because of circumstances and because I just move away from it. It just was a fairly long period of my life, and it isn't where I am anymore, and it isn't, so I just don't participate in it nearly to the extent that I used to. I don't participate in it much. at all. But all these things kind of also relate to how, you know, God-centered, self-centered, interior, exterior. You know, is there solution? I mean, everything in the world. And we talked, when Sandy talked about in the 40s and 50s and 30s, I mean, almost everybody was churched. You could talk about God. It wasn't even an issue. I mean, now we can't even say the Pledge of Allegiance in public school. I mean, we have taken things so far kind of to the other side that we've lost, some common sense, you know, in this process. And it is, you know, so today in that society, in a secular, in a primarily secular view of society, your solution has to be external. I mean, the closest it gets to internal is a psychologist. You know, psychology might be the religion of the day. That's acceptable enough to get, you know, to gain some insight. But psychology, as one of my great spiritual teachers said, it, you know, just takes the transfers the bomb from your lap to under your seat. It doesn't solve the problem. You know, I mean, it is the resolution of most of the serious issues of life need a spiritual resolution. And they are not, and the resolution is what happened to me in Sandy's conversation. The resolution wasn't a resolution of my problem. The resolution is I didn't have a problem. And then I had nothing to say. I mean, there just isn't. You're sitting like a little foolishly in front of your, you know, this place that you've been preparing, you know, for the last 6 months as I wear my hair shirt. And I really told the story well. And then all of a sudden, it's nothing. You know, I mean, it really is. In this moment, you see it in a way that you... And that is how things happen in my program. My partner has a phrase that he uses that I stole that says, see it or be it. If you don't see it, you are it. When you didn't see your alcoholism, it had you. When you saw your alcoholism, when you admitted your alcoholism, you started, that relationship started to change. So when I don't see what Sandy was talking about, and we were talking about in the conversation, it had me. So in this, so all we did was have a conversation. And what I got to do was see it. And it dissolved. I mean, it just see it or be it. I mean, I saw it. And I was able, in this moment, now I will probably return to my suffering post, but but in that moment, I mean, there was nothing to talk about. I mean, I literally had nothing to say that would have been other than baloney, you know, to do it. So it is, so for me, humility is that I'm not exempt. Why should I be surprised when difficult things happen? They happen. Difficult things happen to everybody. So get over it. I mean, you're just one of the group of everybody. I mean, it isn't, you're not exempt. And I really think I've spent a fair amount of my life trying to be exempt.
That's a good point.
I'm glad I had one, finally.
Just to follow up on what Bob was saying about the change in society, I've noticed it in AA. So I'm going to summarize it all. This is how far we've come the other way. I can summarize it all in one sentence. I love being able to reduce things to one sentence. Matter of fact, when I sponsor people and they comment at discussion meetings and it takes them 7 minutes, I go, I want you to go home and reduce that to 2 sentences. And that's very spiritual progress, because simplicity is spirituality. So if you can reduce your comments to 2 sentences, you just got to the essence of what you're trying to say. And it's a great spiritual discipline. So here's my one sentence. In an AA group today, if you mention the word Jesus, you better be swearing. That's my comment on today. A couple more things on humility. We do humble things all the time, and we don't see them as humble. If you go to a meeting, it's an act of humility. Why are you going to the meeting? Because you need help. You're not going to make it through life unless you go there. If you read the big book, it's an act of humility. Boy, I'm going to read this. I need help. If you pray, it's an act of humility. And one of the great acts of humility is anonymity. That you simply are, you don't have a resume anymore. You're just Joe the drunk. How simple that is. That's my whole who I am. Just a name, and I'm an alcoholic. That's a huge act of humility. So we're engaging in humble acts all the time. And I think if we saw it that way, the word would become a bigger part of our vocabulary. We'd be able to talk about it a lot more. Now, are we going to get another topic, or are we going to go for questions?
Questions.
We just got the answer to that. Okay, we're going to do this, and if we don't get any, I'll ask Bob questions.
And that is what we call desperation as opposed to humility.
There we go. Thank you. You saved us. Here comes a microphone.
I'm Jim. I'm an alcoholic. Could you give us an example of when one of your sponsees comes to you with a problem, how you give them a pair of glasses to look at it?
Yeah.
Do you want to start or do you want me to start?
Well, I'm not going to touch it.
Okay, I use the same technique my sponsor used on me when I was new. When I would go to him every month, the sky is falling. If you remember when you're new, the end of the world is just around the corner every other day, and then you'd run in. And he would listen to all this stuff. You know, I'm going to get through all the Marine Corps. I got six kids. We don't have enough money. I don't think we're going to starve to death. Now, why was that a problem for me? Because I kept thinking about it. Do you follow what I'm saying? Let me start out with this. How many people here have a problem that's not bothering you? Okay, so the essence of a problem is that it's bothering you. So if we could get you unbothered, would you still have a problem? No. In other words, when you go to the 10th step, if something disturbs you, no matter what the cause, there's something wrong with you, and then they show you how to get undisturbed, honest analysis, and open-mindedness, willingness to forgive, and a willingness to make amends. So anyway, I went to him with all these problems, and he said, okay, yeah, I hear that, but wait a minute, you know, you're scheduled to talk next week up in that big meeting up in Washington. And I went, yeah, I am. He said, you know, they really enjoy you. You're funny, and they really get a kick out of that. So I'm looking forward to driving up there. You see where he's going? He's taking me down a different road. We're not even going to talk about what it is that's got me upset. And then he said, and you're sponsoring the guy now. How's he doing? Oh, he's doing great. What step are you on? Oh, we're on the second step. Yeah, I'm going to teach him this and this and that. So after a while, he said, well, how do you feel now? And I said to him, well, if you look at it that way, I guess I don't have as big a problem as I thought I did. So what did he do? He caused me to look at life a different way. And if I'm not thinking about the problem, it doesn't exist. There are people with terminal cancer. When they're not thinking about it, they're the same as everybody else. And then their ego wants them to go think about it, feel sorry for themselves, and turn it into a terrible problem. And then they get free helping somebody else, and then it's not a problem. So it is all helping someone to see and think differently so that they're not disturbed by the situation. It's just a situation. When it upsets us, it's a problem. You get rid of the upset. That's why, Bob, you started the whole thing out. I'm afraid God's going to make me happy and poor. You follow what I'm saying? That is the answer. In other words, if you're unhappy financially and somebody can make you happy, the problem's gone. But it's not the solution he wanted. But it's the solution. And so anyway, that's what I do on that area. So that's all. I don't know.
TV alcoholic. I know, Sandy, you talk a lot about what you do across the country. You bring people good news. And I was wondering, how hard is it to get up there and do what you guys do and keep the ego out of it?
That's yours. I don't know how to do that.
The short answer is that I don't. I think it's interesting in Asia, most people who do anything for which we would get attention, whether it would be you were the group leader for a couple of months or whatever task of service, I think often in service we get called by our ego. You know, you do the presentation in the meeting. There's a part of that that's attractive, and we get called through it. That may get you there. It won't keep you there. So over a period of time, it becomes more ordinary, something that you're able to do with a different facility. You look at it differently, and I think most of the time we look at it as service. And there are ego-enhancing aspects to it. People treat you nicely. They tell you, oh, you did a wonderful job. There's still ego sorts of things in it, but I really think after you do it a while, it becomes more of just a service. There are times when you believe your press. There are times when you're more elated when people are blowing smoke at you. Not smoke. I grew up listening to talks. They made a very big difference in my sobriety. And I think I was, I don't know if I was so interested because at one point in time I was going to, you know, have to do that. But I think everything in life, we have an opportunity to act either with our ego or with some humility. And I think that's something as spiritual people with principles, we have to learn. And sometimes we don't do it perfectly. But over a period of time, I think with the principles that we have, we don't tolerate ego. It's really funny. In our society, I think if we had someone who was overly prideful about something, we'd start to reduce asking them. Pass.
Yeah. It's, when people come up and they give you all this, oh, you helped me, you did this, blah, blah, blah. It's easy to get a high out of that, which would be the ego. Oh, yeah. It makes me feel sick when I do it. I just feel terrible about that because I know that this is God's, gets all the credit for everything in AA. And I'll give you an example of it recently. Because of my daughter's death, I got a bunch of people in AA from all over started writing me cards. I think I got 240 of them from all over the place. And a lot of the cards said, well, I don't know you, but I've been listening to this, and you really mean the little, little, and I'm so sorry to hear what happened. And so these things started piling up in a big basket. And so a friend of mine came over one day, and I said, let me show you all these cards. And I was having him read so he could read all these nice things these people said about me. It had nothing to do with my daughter. And I started having that feeling as I gave it to him, and I just took him and put it in the other room. But it's very easy for that ego part to sneak back in. It looks for any opportunity to direct the attention. So here I am directing the attention from my daughter to me, and it looked innocent. You know what I'm saying? If somebody could sit there and go, oh yeah, this is so, and they don't realize, yeah, but did you read the part about me? And that's when you take the basket and go put it in the other room. So as Bob said, nobody's immune from this. You better get used to it, because you're going to get caught up every day, and then you just, we got a whole step about that, and when you're wrong, promptly admit it. Well, that was screwed up. Give me that basket. And then go in there. And lastly, and don't beat yourself up over it. Don't go, oh my God, I can't believe, you know, that's pride again. I can't believe I fell for that. That's good. I mean, you're compounding the felony.
Hi, I'm Nancy, and I'm an alcoholic. My question for Sandy, I admire spirituality. Could you tell me what the third step meant to you back when you first got sober, and if it still means the same to you now, and if you find yourself taking your will back, what do you do to give it back over to God?
Well, very quickly, I just covered turning it back over is to admit you're wrong. Boy, being wrong is ticket to peace of mind. Okay, wrong. So that's up. You get your spirituality back. You're wrong. I let it go. I did this, I did that. The third step in the beginning is very different than it is now, because in the beginning, my sponsor explained to me, he used the second step in the big book, the chapter of the agnostic, where it says, you have a disease that only a spiritual experience can conquer. So he said, your disease requires that a higher power appear or you're dead. So I was sort of getting a mafia-like understanding about whether I'm going to choose God or not. So I'm looking at the third step, making a decision, and he's standing behind me with a gun. So I'm going to make this decision because there's nowhere else to go. I have to change my mind or the gun goes off. Do you follow what I'm saying? But now that I've had the full experience of God, it's a very joyful thing. And the third step is especially joyful to me when I'm sponsoring someone and we come to this obstacle of their ego not wanting them to turn their life over, and to make it so attractive that they decide to do it. It's so exciting to see that crucial decision being made in another human being's life.
Mm-hmm. I'm an ant on a log going down the river. It has the illusion. It looks like I'm steering the log.
Yes. There's a hand way over there. Oh, okay.
Hi, my name's Eric. I'm an alcoholic.
Hey, Eric.
I'm working with someone right now that's really struggling with the God issue. Do you think that the struggle with the God issue has changed that much over the last 30 or so years? Thank you.
Yeah, I think it... I've got a part of me that could answer that no, but yeah, I do. I just think that we're so secular today. I think that everybody, there are people today that haven't been churched at all. I mean, haven't even had almost any preliminary conversations about God or what they believe. I mean, most of the problems that we have in our society around God, I think our problem is laziness. I mean, we don't read anything about God. We keep talking about how important it is, and then we don't want anybody to know that we've really haven't read anything about it or even talked about it much. So we just, a lot of times the answer we give is, you know, is to close down the conversation. Because it's like nuclear physics. It isn't something, you know, I mean, I don't want to sit down and have a half-hour conversation about nuclear physics. I don't understand it. I don't read anything about it. What would I have to say? I mean, you know, and you just expose that in any kind of a conversation I got onto, it would quickly be disclosed that I have almost no experience in the conversation. And that is more so today with more people, I think, than it ever has been. What also is wonderful about it is once you open the conversation, there are things that you can help them recognize and see as part of that conversation that they have never thought about or recognize and see. You can start to see the natural knower inside of them, the sense of being the God inside of them. And as Sandy said, that's a pretty wonderful thing to be able to assist what is kind of a transformation taking place. But I think it's different because our society is different. And there's almost no external encouragement for it except in the pretty strongly organized religions.
Okay, one comment. When I run into, you know, an atheist or somebody who doesn't want to hear about God or anything like that, I follow what the big book suggests. And the big book says, oh, well, let's not worry about that. Let's go to a meeting. Let's talk about this. Just keep an open mind. Don't worry about that. And you just, you don't go into the debate. All right, well, let's settle this issue right now. You say no, I say yes. That would ruin everything. So you go, oh, well, let's not worry about that yet. That'll come later. And we're just talking about the steps and surrender, and we're doing this, and he's going to meetings, and I love to go to speaker meetings. When I got sober, all the meetings were speaker meetings. Few discussion, but you couldn't go there. You had 3 months, and then you couldn't talk. And so they will hear attractive things about God from other people, and one of them will be just like them. And so the work will slowly get done, and they'll be attracted to reconsidering as you're working them through the steps.
Have you ever heard any commentary about the why section in the big book from individuals who have experience and relationships as well as long-term sobriety? And there's always been some commentary on how the why section came to be. But in your relationships, how did you manage the paradoxes of work through my problems, or I supposedly work through my problems, and then come back and critique others and carry yourself throughout your lives. How do you feel about relationships with wives?
How do I feel? I can't hear.
I'm having trouble hearing the question.
I've never heard anything in regards to a setting like this, in regards to a wife's.
Wife?
The wife's. The wives.
Oh, chapter to wives. Yeah. Oh, yeah, okay.
So, and what's the question with respect to the chapter to the wives?
Any feedback in regards to wives and how to conduct themselves and work through the process of sobriety and relationships? And anything in your experiences that you can give some insight on?
Well, I had one observation, and that is there are many new women who don't like the chapter. New to AA. Yeah. Because it's so out of touch with today's reality. And once again, don't engage in an argument. Don't try to prove that it's okay. But make a little bet inside of your head that 2 years from now, they'll find a lot of beautiful things in there. And that resentment at the foreign nature of it compared to today's way of things will slowly disappear because there's a lot of beautiful things in there. But I certainly am sympathetic with somebody who would look at that and be offended almost. But you just let time fix these things because you just can't jump in and, no, you're wrong, you shouldn't feel that way. So I'm sympathetic to your point. Did I do that all right?
Yeah.
Yeah, I go to a sober house on Tuesday nights, most Tuesday nights, and it's all men, and they read chapter to the family, and they read the chapter to the spouse, and they almost always initially start out saying, well, I don't have much to say, I'm, you know, don't like one. And then as their stay lengthens, they start to become more sensitive about their own experience within their family, and they start to mine things out of that they don't. But at the end, the question to me when you said, well, we have advice, you know, Bill wrote that chapter,
yeah.
Which I always thought was a little unusual. And secondly, I would find myself thinking, I wish my wife were here. You know, the Al-Anon experience of, you know, before and after, because, I mean, that really is the essence of what, and we're the carriers. So, done.
Here we go.
Jim, I'm an alcoholic. And I had a question for Bob. I have a comment first.
It's about time.
You know, in the big book, there's a sentence that says that deep down inside every man, woman, and child is the fundamental idea of God. And in my early sobriety, I heard Bob and Sybil out of California. Bob talked about, you know, he said, I'm going to stand up here today. He was raised an atheist. He said, I'm going to stand up here today and talk to you about God. And then Stan C. out of Canada, he openly said, you know, that he had never been raised in a church, but yet he had that feeling inside of him every time he did something, you know, that went against the nature of God. And that's how I started out too, you know, was every time I did something, I had that feeling inside. So I believe that sentence in the big book.
Mm-hmm.
I was going to ask Bob, in these different countries that you've been to, how did they open and close their meetings? And then I have another thing, too, that at the General Service Conference this year, they were supposed to vote on a pamphlet that was going to address
atheism.
Atheists and non-believers.
Yeah.
And
Bad idea.
It lost out in favor of pregnant nuns on motorcycles pamphlet. We have a... we have... I think the I didn't have enough of exposure in China to be able to answer your question. The meetings, many of the meetings I went to were with expatriates, and they open and close like we open and close our meetings. So many of the meetings you go to in foreign countries are. The meeting I went to in India was not in Hindi, it was in English. Now, that was there. I mean, English is one of the main languages of India. It was not there were mostly Indians at the meeting. And they conducted the meeting the same way we would here, with the same prayers and the same, I don't remember if they said the Lord's Prayer or their Serenity Prayer, but you wouldn't find, my memory of it is that there was nothing different. Same thing in South Africa. But most of the meetings in foreign countries I've been to have been comprised, you know, in the Scandinavian countries where they were not comprised of expatriates, I, to whatever extent I understood what was going on, and I think I did. Their format and what they did was quite similar to what we do. And I do believe that there's a knower. When we can quiet our minds enough, either through meditation or what happens, I think what happens is we bring our wet log to the bonfire of AA. And I think it starts to dry out. And we are, and what happens a little bit is we check our brains at the door. And you move into the group for the hour that the group's going on, and there's a collective conscious in the group. And you join it, and it has an impact on you. I think when you come in sad, the group raises you, so you're not quite as sad. When you come in separate, angry, whatever it is, I think you rise, the impact of the collective consciousness of the group, and that, to some extent, then we start to take that outside, you know. But at first, it's only in the group that we have any kind of, you know, peace or resolution. But there are things that, You're in a meeting, and someone like Sandy says something, and you go, oh, yeah. You don't go, oh, I agree with that. Geez, that's interesting. I mean, your soul just goes, oh, yeah. It doesn't think it's okay. It doesn't think it's correct. It knows it is so. And you start to have an experience of your knower, which is getting pretty close to your higher power. And I think we have those experiences with some regularity in Alcoholics Anonymous. I think we see when whoever talked about Sandy or whoever, David, when the change happens to someone, they look different. Mm-hmm. They don't look, I mean, they're different. So when you talk about the spirit, I mean, and we see that. We see that often. So I really think we get a chance to see it and touch it and feel it. And there aren't many places I think one could go to see it more often than we have the opportunity to see it.
My name is Craig, and I'm an alcoholic. This has been a very powerful conference for me. I like to get a little emotional. Anyway, you shared, Bob, that when a person shared their experience, strength, and hope, that people in AA are sensitive to the fact that they don't want to hear your ideology, your philosophy, your religion, your dogma, or anything like that, that they just want to hear your experience, strength, and hope on how you have come to know your higher power and how it's working for you. I'm thinking that about a label that as soon as you mention the word atheist, to me, it's like you're attaching a negative label to a person because it doesn't fit their your idea of God or whatever. It's like when I think of atheists, there's three types of theism: atheism, monotheism, and polytheism. And it's like as soon as you put a person and say he's an atheist, you want to make it negative when AA automatically it says that we have a higher power of our understanding. And some people just do not choose to call that God. It's a higher power of their understanding. So I have a great struggle with that.
Yeah, that's an interesting point. I think we have a prejudice. So, you know, it's always the problem of the majority. You know, we all have a tendency to think a certain way, and atheism is not a common, you know, it's not something that we run into every day. And, you know, it's not as common, certainly, as it seems to be, as someone who's theistic. That's been an interesting point I've taken. And it's 2:30, and we need an hour between us. So thank you very much. But good to be with you.